Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedies in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedies in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very gladly ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedies in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremediesinthelaw.com, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedies in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremediesinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedies in the Law. And Your Remedies in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. And if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of what you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, and you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. And there's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always for the best. We plan for the best. And believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen. And when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you call board and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, thank you very much, Martin. I appreciate your disclaimer and the good information that you passed on to everybody here tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, I implore you to listen very carefully to my introduction for PJ tonight. I had the opportunity to communicate with an attorney today from an organization called the United States Concealed Carry Association. You may have seen them on the internet where they're offering membership and then providing legal services to its members who are caught, if you would, or having a situation where they are in possession of a firearm and, they're going to have hell to pay for that. Anyways, so I had written this gentleman, this attorney, and in writing him, let me see where I've got this here. One second. I said, thank you, George98, that's what his handle is. What are your thoughts on this? And what this was the kind of a missive, if you would, a lengthy writing of a collection of all of different things that are very, very pertinent to the question of jurisdiction. And I wrote that to him, and to my surprise, absolute surprise, he responded. One second here. He says, welcome, Michael 1494. That's me. I'm not sure the context of each of these decisions. These were court decisions that I had displayed with him and gave a narrative regarding them, but I am familiar with a few of them. The initial premise that we are citizens are subject to the laws of both the United States and the state in which we reside, hear the word reside, is somewhat correct, but it isn't that simple. If I leave Kentucky and go to Indiana, I am subject to an Indiana law. If a non-citizen is in Kentucky, he is subject to Kentucky and federal law. It is true that almost every person in the United States or territory is subject to both the laws of the federal and state/territory law. The laws generally apply to citizens and non-citizens alike based on the location of the person. And this is my response. This is what I want you to pay attention to, please. When a man who is honestly mistaken hears the truth, he can no longer be mistaken, or he's no longer honest. Just as John Marshall Harlan predicted much of what has occurred, quote, the idea prevails with some, indeed it has found expression in arguments at the bar, that we have in this country substantially two national governments, one to be maintained under the Constitution with all its restrictions, the other to be maintained by the Congress outside and independently of that instrument by exercising both powers as other nations of the earth are accustomed to. In other words, other nations of the earth basically are a dictatorship in one form or another, be it benevolent or not benevolent, be it a monarchy, an oligarchy, or whatever it is. That's what the other nations are accustomed to, is to telling their little people what to do. I wrote him, continuing, I said, firstly, Michael, Mike BKY, allow me to sincerely and profusely thank you for your response. In over 100 plus emails I've sent to various nationally known organizations to their attorneys, you are the first to respond. So thank you. I have bolded and highlighted below portions of your reply to this address. Now, I've already read you his reply. So what I bolded and highlighted was the word reside. Reside is the key word. Do you know the definition of residence? Quoting the D.C. Council at its sections 47 through 18.1.4, it says, resident means an individual domiciled in the district at any time during the taxable year, end quote. Are any of the several states, quote, within the freely associated compact states, end quote, in or part of a district? Are there more districts than just the District of Columbia? Simply put, a resident or one who resides within the freely associated compact states is, in law, domiciled within 10 miles of the seat of power, territories, possessions, or enclaves of the United States, quoting Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. And then I quoted some court cases. I'm going to repeat them here for the purposes of this recording so that you have them. They're on prior recordings, but let's get to this. U.S. versus Valentine, 288 F Supplement 957, quote, the only, and then I put in brackets, singular, only. Are there not many more rights in the Bill of Rights? Close bracket. The only absolute and unqualified right of a United States citizen is to residence within the territorial boundaries of the United States. Wheeling Steel Corporation versus Fox, 298 U.S. 193, 80 LED, 1143. Quote, therefore, the U.S. citizen, open bracket, citizens of the District of Columbia, close bracket, residing in one of the states of the Union are classified as property and franchises of the federal government as an individual entity. Hendricks versus Maryland, SC Reporters, quote, a U.S. citizen upon leaving the District of Columbia becomes involved in interstate commerce as a resident and does not have the common law right to travel of a citizen of one of the several states. I emboldened, does not have the common law right of a citizen of one of the several states. Maxwell versus Dow, 20 SCR 448 at page 455, quote, the privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States do not necessarily include all the rights protected by the first eight amendments of the federal Constitution against the powers of the federal government. City of Dallas versus Mitchell, 245 Southwest 944. The rights of the individuals are restricted only to the extent that they have been voluntarily surrendered by the citizenship to the agencies of government, end quote. Houston versus Moore. Every citizen of a state owes a double allegiance. He enjoys the protection and participates in the government of both the state and the United States, end quote. And then the last quotation, United States versus Cruikshank, 92 U.S. 542-551, quote, it is the natural consequence of a citizenship which owes allegiance to two sovereignties, and claims protection from both. He owes allegiance to the two departments, so to speak, and within their respective spheres must pay the penalties with each exacts for disobedience to its laws. In return, he can demand protection from each within its own jurisdiction. Again, within its own jurisdiction. So, the question begs, at the time of whatever it is that happened, what is the land jurisdiction you are on, and what class of citizenship are you? What jurisdiction of citizenship? The state and federal constitutions are an estoppel. They are a bar against government to even address any of the enumerated and unenumerated rights of the people. I promise you, a team of people I provide oversight to have stopped this state from proceeding against their students simply by demanding the prosecutor to establish upon the court's record authenticated evidence of the territorium and the personam jurisdiction of both parties. And the court simply won't go there. Well, what happens if you were to do this for any of your members? You would be pulled into chambers and warned never to go there. And first, the warning is gentle. And depending on your willingness to push the issue, next would be the threat of disbarment. And should you become very aggressive, your very life will be threatened. My associations go into places you may only dream of enjoying, names you recognize in the headlines daily. This is not bravado. This is fact. And if you'd like a private conference call with a few of my closest associates, I could make that happen if you were willing. Yours in freedom. And then I signed off. We mutually pledged to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor, the men who signed the Declaration of Independence. So this is my response to an attorney who basically didn't give me an answer. His answer was just fluff. It was without substance. It was just an answer. So without further ado, for PJ to uncompact what I just talked about, I think you're in for a heck of a ride tonight. So let me bring forth and let me welcome PJ, speaker for tonight's call.
Yeah, it was interesting. One of those cases, it talked about the synonymous, talked about the domicile in the District of Columbia, jurisdiction thereof is a department, and then another department is the state in which they reside. So, now if they're departments, if you have a box that has, you got a singular box, it's got different departments in it, it's still the same, still in the same box. So, I believe that the state of Nebraska, for example, is the department of the, they actually call it statehood, and they have to comply with federal requirements to provide a republic for the government. I believe it's just a department of the United States, and the Supremacy Clause absolutely governs that department. Of course, that same Supremacy Clause, or the same laws apply to the jurisdiction of the District of Columbia. So, the main thing is that you keep the burden of proof on them. If anybody claims that you have a right to, that you do not have a right to do something, in this conversation we're kind of focusing on the right to have a Glock rifle or a Glock pistol. They're going to claim that you have to buy that from the right person, and you have to register it. Sometimes you might have to get your own personal license. And then you get different licenses for concealed carry or open carry, a whole host of things. And then if you get pulled over for a going 5 miles an hour over the speed limit, and if the first 10 words out of your mouth is not, I have a firearm in the car, well, they'll take your $500 that away from you and will not give it back to you. Anyway, it's a whole host of things. And then if you have the, you have it stored in your car and it's not locked in a box, inside of a box, inside of a box, inside of a box in the glove compartment, they'll give you a ticket for it, or, and then take the gun away from you, you'll lose again. So basically, they're just stripping, your right to have that block in your access, your ready access. You don't want a gun you carry because you're going to need it, and you got about 1.5 seconds to get that gun. In most cases, when you really need it, and a lot of times even less time than that. So the thing that's most bringing up is the United States is a military document, a military entity, and of course they have gun regulations that are copacetic to a military base. It's all government land, all land of the United States, all land of the state of Nebraska, for example, has a military purpose. And if it doesn't have a military purpose, they have to give up the land, give it back to the public, the general public's use. So the National Riflemen's Association, for example, they probably had extremely good intentions when they started. And guess what? The lawyers, Paul Harvey calls it slime. The lawyer slime worked its way into under the door and into every crack in organizations like that and scrub out the truth. I'm not talking about reveal the truth. They scrub it out and throw it out the window because they'll start convincing their members that, oh, yeah, you got to go down and get your permit. You got to get registered, and you got to have it associated with a United States address, city, county, state address. And they're just locking you in to the appearance of being solely government governed as to that pistol to the United States. And it's lie after lie after lie after lie. I talked to one of the most knowledgeable lawyers that I've ever met. He said that we have as a free American man, you have a right to carry a pistol into a federal courtroom if you so choose. There is no law against that. Now, they would have to prove that you are a threat to them, and that would have to go in front of a common law jury. But it cannot go in front of their judge. It has to go in front of a common law jury. And I think most common law juries would say, that's probably not a good idea. But they would also probably have a strong consideration that, the U.S. Marshal has a gun in there, and the sheriffs have guns in there. Right. Why don't we have a right to ourselves? It'd be quite interesting, but they don't want to go down that path. They want to have it exposed that the U.S. have say so about where a man can carry a firearm. Only the common law jury does. Quite interesting. So, one of my friends, he's basically the highest level lawyer I've ever met. He walks right into federal court and says, Your Honor, where in the Constitution does it state that my client does not have a right to have a gun on him right now? And the judge knows what he's doing. He's not really saying he's got a gun on him. He's just saying, you're saying he might have a gun on him because he's 500 feet from a parking lot of a school, for example, or even on school grounds. You know, some of these teachers are pretty dangerous environment. Guess what? They don't have a right to some of the state jurisdictions, the federal jurisdictions, they don't have a right to have a device on them called a pistol for a defense. So where in the world, now I understand that a federal building, a federal school, that's possible that they don't have a right to have a gun there. If you go into some buildings, there's gun everywhere and highly explosive material, and lighter there are tremendous limitations to certain devices, certain environments for safety reasons. But if you have the Constitution, one of the enumerated out of the many rights that you have, only a few of them are enumerated. It says right in the Constitution, this is not all your rights. It's just a few of the ones that we decided. The freedom of speech, the freedom of the press, the freedom of right to bear arms is one of them. So where in the world is what's the right? Did I say you were signed that I would want to bear arms? They have to produce that evidence. Now, once they produce that evidence, you have a right to take that in front of a common law jury and let the jury decide. The U.S. The minister is supposed to decide that. The jury is supposed to decide that. Otherwise, a U.S. administrator would say, oh, we got land jurisdiction on every square inch between the Pacific and the Atlantic. And if you don't like it, you can appeal it to my best friend that I golf with every day. And if you don't like that, you can appeal it to that I play cards with every week. And if you don't like that, you can appeal it to the guy I went to college with. You know, they're just a good old boys club. So you don't get worked up at those high levels without being part of the good old boys club. You have to support the state as they've been trying to establish for the last 200 years. So, Michael, as far as I know, the best way to challenge jurisdiction as to the requirement to have a license, registration, so forth for a gun is to challenge jurisdiction. So you just do it in a format. And something different, I think, charged with a crime, you have a paper trail asking them where you can get a gun and where you cannot carry a gun. If they refuse to answer, like, how in the world can they come in and say, oh, you can't carry a gun in that car? Well, I've been asked, I wrote three letters, and here they're all certified. And the way to certify a letter is to put into an envelope and hand it right to the mail, certified mail, and he takes it away from you. So, envelope, they're not allowed to give it back to you. It has to go to the delivery. They did allow me to write on the envelope, correct the zip code, but they would not allow me to open it up. I said, oh, the zip code is not right. They go, no, it's not right. Can I open it up and change the zip code on the other side? Nope. Once it has,
you're breaking up, PJ. You're breaking up. Do you have a weak signal where you're at, where you are?
I got four bars here.
Okay, well, now you're strong. You're strong now, but you were going in and out a moment ago.
Yeah, cut in. Off on deck.
So you're cutting in. You're cutting in and out again. Damn.
Okay, let me go. I'm in a sailboat, the metal hull.
Go on deck. Go up on deck, please.
Yeah. Bug's gonna eat me alive up there. I'll be all right.
You're feeding nature. Let the mosquitoes have at you. You're feeding nature. You're doing a good
thing. Well, I'm looking at the light out here, and there's no bugs around it. That's a good sign. Last night, I couldn't hardly see the light. Last night, you couldn't hardly see the light. There were so many bugs around it. Okay, tell me where I was at.
Whatever you were saying, you may as well start over because we really couldn't have a clear shot at what you were saying.
Okay. Okay. Well, tell me where I was at. I've been talking for quite a while.
Yeah, all right. We were just talking about jurisdiction, the difference between federal land, land of the several states and the union, how the federal government has through our own ignorance allowed for them to come in as lords and masters of us, etc.
Okay, yeah, it's quite interesting. People that I work with, they meet with U.S. Marshals. And they ask them questions, and they say, you know, you guys are enforcing this, and you're not allowing a tape recorder to go into the courtrooms, and we got client after client after client that says that the record's been changed in the court, that the court clerk actually changes the record, and the tape recorder's tampered with, you know, where in the Constitution it says the courts are open. How come the courts are not open? You know, we can't take a recorder in there. I was in a courtroom once. They wouldn't let a person take a piece of paper and an ink pen in there. It's crazy. When they have an important case, it's going to potentially damage them a great deal. And a firearm case are those type of cases. They have those hearings. They're not even allowed to have a piece of paper, and they're in an ink pen. Crazy! I couldn't believe that my people that I work with allowed them to take their paper away and their ink pen away before they went into the courtroom. I would have put up such a big fuss. I would have called the U.S. Marshal over there. And, you know, where in the world did the open Constitution said the cases, the courts will be open to the public? Now, where in the world do they decide how open it is? Just like the Constitution says the right to bear arms. You know, where did they get the right to determine what the right to bear arms means? Well, that means you can have a black powder flint gun. You know, that doesn't mean you can have any other gun than that. You know, where in the world did they get that right? But anyway, if you want to challenge jurisdiction, you just challenge jurisdiction. I was talking about how you challenge their jurisdiction in a written format. The best way to do it is you can write the document out in a negative and positive averments, an affidavit form, and you send it to them. For example, the affidavit that you send it to them is signed under penalty of perjury, and you just give them a copy. You keep the original, but you, if you send them a copy, that is evident that you have the original with you. And I usually put on the document the original retained by the signed. So you fill out these negative and positive averments, and let's just say it, you want to carry a gun in a specific location. Let's say you have a piece of land. You know, you just draw a 50-mile circle around your house, and you just ask them, is there anywhere here that I'm not allowed to carry a gun? And give them your full name and your mailing location and so forth. And then you mail it. You have the envelope all ready to mail, a certified document tracking on the front, and you film it. You have a friend film it. As you load it, show your face. Show you loading it, and you seal it. You never take that camera off that envelope, and then you hand it to the mailman. So they'll stamp it immediately, and then you you keep filming it until you see that red stamp on that, that certified letter. Because once it's stamped, they cannot give it back to you. They have to, if you ever notice, they're supposed to receive payment before they stamp it. So once it's received, sealed, address is checked, and then paid for, then they can stamp it. Because then it becomes in their custody, and they have a duty to deliver it. So once it's stamped, and with that red stamp, you got proof that it went to them. And then, of course, you got the tracking number. You can track the delivery time and so forth. But that is excellent evidence of notice to them as to your question to any jurisdictional issue. And from that point on, they have tremendous difficulty ever charging you with a crime or a fine or a fee, a late fee or anything like that. May it be property taxes, state taxes, gun registration, requirement to have a driver's license. Everything they ask people to do, you can challenge jurisdiction that way. Just make sure you don't lose that original and don't lose that tracking number. Put that tracking number right on the document in the affidavit before you mail it. So, any questions, Michael?
All right. Well, let's go to questions. Press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen, to raise your hand. Press star 2, not pound 2. It's underneath the 7. Star 2 to raise your hand. Those of you on Freedoms Radio, you'll notice to the center of your monitor, there is a silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side. Just left-click inside of that, type away your comment or your question. On the outside of the rectangle, there's a place to put your name and contact information, and then just hit submit, and I'll be happy to give voice to your comment, to your question. So first, I'm going to go over to Freedoms Radio real quick just to see if anybody has intuitively processed that. We'll see in just a moment. And look at Freedoms Radio, and what we have is a blank screen. Come on, hit refresh. And press again, press star 2 in your keypad while we're waiting for this to populate. If not, we're going to have a really short call tonight. Ed writes in, he's been breaking up. Yeah, well, I think we covered that. I'd like to know about 42 USC section 1982 stuff. Can you talk about, first off, 42, section 42, 19, title 42, 1983 section? And can you tell me the difference, PJ, between you quoting that in paperwork, in filings, versus not quoting the title and section, but rather just quoting the verbiage? Go ahead.
So you always want to quote the location of it. And go ahead.
All right. If you quote the location of it, then you are using their code. But if you quote the verbiage of it, that verbiage is as powerful in common law as it is in the federal laws. But anyways, I'm not here to disagree with you. I just wanted to ask you to talk about it.
Yeah, it's you always put a disclaimer in there that that paper cannot be used to create any form of jurisdiction. I always put that on my documents. And some lawyers have read that and they go, wow, that's pretty smart. If you're going to go into court under 42 United States Code 1983, I quote the whole statute, and you want to make sure that you find it accurate. Go right to the Cornell Law and copy it exactly. If you're in court and you find out that the word if is missing or something, the judge will throw it out. So you want to get it exact. They'll watch that really close. They like to do that. They like to find out if now if you're missing a one letter or something, it doesn't change the content, then it's not quite so big. But there are billion-dollar contracts that are screwed up because some lawyer forgot to put a comma in there. So those it's really important to get that right. But when you file in 1883, you file it under the 1983 and common law. So because the United States is clearly instructed, all the officers and agents, what's the other one, I can't remember, but basically the judges, administrators, they're required to take heed to common law. So every time we file a 1983, we add the common law provision in there. And if you read a bunch of 1983s, you'll see that a lot of lawyers do add the common law aspect in there. Because you got to remember that 1983 is to show that your rights have been violated and you're seeking compensation and to be made whole. And just, and ideally to cease their behavior. And the Constitution clearly says that not all your rights are enumerated. So, if they're not all enumerated, how are you gonna be able to rely on their documents to address them? The Constitution doesn't enumerate all of them. Guarantee that their written laws of Congress don't enumerate all of them. So that's why you can add the common law provision in your 1983. And then you ask the under common law, you're asking the jury to determine the law and the facts of the case. You're not asking the judge. And they don't like to admit this, and it's difficult because you're going into a jurisdiction. One of your main claims is that they stepped outside of their jurisdiction and damaged you. And there's a provision in law that if that happens, you can go in under 1983 and seek damages. So they came into your common law jurisdiction, and they're asking you to use their statutory provision to notify them of that. So you just make it clear to them that, hey, you guys are the one that came into this land jurisdiction and misbehaved. So now you claim that I don't use your form properly. Well, that's why I got the verbiage on there for American common law. And we'll let the jury just, whenever you use the word common law, it actually means the jury will decide the law and the facts of the matter. So you can stress that. Now, if you've got a really good case, they usually settle out of court. They don't want to drag this into court, especially if they find that you're a notable person and you have a following. Internet causes that following ability into the thousands. Didn't exist in the past for very many people. And they don't want to teach people how to come in and prevail on simple deprivation of rights case. They don't want those cases out there floating. The best 1983 case you can put together is one page, very simple, very direct, and tell them to produce evidence that that guy had authority to do what he did. Not only do what he did, but to do it against you. And to do it in a specific area of land, which is a three-dimensional space. Okay, Michael, next.
All right, thank you so much. I hope that answered Ed's questions. Next is Brian from Grand Prairie, Texas. Go ahead, Brian.
Thank you, Michael. Question is really a hypothetical on a controversial current topic, vaccinations, and there's many reasons. I guess the folks are proposing they're out there, they're life saving, they're depopulation, they're money. But there's one wild one that's being thrown around there about intellectual property and changing DNA and becoming property thereof something. based on a Monsanto case. I think it was 2013, and DNA, RNA on corn. Is there any, I mean, in your mind, would there be, if there was any changing of DNA, which, you know, that's highly speculative and other things like that, would there be any possibility to that?
Is that a question to me? Because my phone blinked out. I was gone for the last minute and a half.
Well, let me precede PJ's answer with one particular court case. If I can find it real quick, it's because it hits the nail on the head of what you're talking about.
Okay.
It's about,
yeah.
Here we
go.
Wadley versus Newell. This is a circuit court from the Northern District of California. Quote, civil rights under the 14th Amendment are for federal citizens and not state citizens. Federal citizens, as parents, have no right to the custody of their infant children except subject to the paramount right of the state. Now, that's one. And then the other one is about you being property. Hold on. Where is that? It's right here somewhere. Here we go. Wheeling Steel Corporation versus Fox. Therefore, the U.S. citizen, quote, bracket, citizens of the District of Columbia, close bracket, residing, there's a key word, in one of the states of the union, are classified as property and franchises of the federal government. So whether you're a full-grown adult, if you're deemed a federal citizen, you're deemed property. If you're a married couple and you have an infant child, a minor, you have no right to the custody of that minor, except when the state says it's okay. So if the state, for whatever reason, says it's not okay, your child's taken from you. Only federal citizens are subject to that, not citizens of the state.
Right.
Go ahead, PJ.
I don't think you heard the question, Michael.
Well, repeat the question, please.
PJ, I was talking about the vaccines and theorized purpose or theorized, you know, alternate reason for them is intellectual property purposes, and there's speculation that one of the vaccines will change your DNA and therefore make you no longer human, make you no longer sovereign and unable to apply certain rights.
I don't agree with that at all.
Goes back to a Monsanto.
Ask a jury. Are you cutting out here? Can you hear me?
No, ask a jury to agree.
You know, a jury's not going to agree with them. They're going to say, what? No. No. Your shot doesn't change my humanity at all. Go ahead.
It is based on a Monsanto corn hearing, I think, where the... But they ruled that, you know, if the DNA was changed, they ruled against the farmer or something like that. So that's a court case where they're claiming speculation over the change of the DNA will claim ownership of the organism.
Yeah, that's because the produce of that cross genetic change. I mean, it's a very unique genetic structure. And anyway, you can bring a jury in and you can argue that if you, let's say you've had some genetics that were very close to theirs and they tried to claim it was theirs. You can take it to a jury. Hey, I'm raising this on my land, not of the government, and you guys got a beef with me? Okay, let's take it to a jury. Because in some nations, Monsanto and went in there, I think it's Monsanto with, but anyway, their DNA spread into all the other fields. And they tried to go in and say, hey, our DNA's showing up in their crops, so it must be ours.
Right.
Baloney. And that's one reason some of the countries won't allow that stuff to be in their country, because they realize that it got contaminated the rest of the fields. So, but anyway, in America, that's the beauty of America. Everything boils down to the jury of 12. Everything boils down to the jury of 12. Now, the jury of 12 can actually get together and decide that, hey, no, you took the oath of military service, so you're subject to the military courts. That's the way it is. But a jury of 12 has to determine that. Some, 12 men cannot walk up to you, or 100 men cannot walk up to you and force you into military service and say, oh no, you signed this document, you came up, you showed up, blah, 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 blah. No, I didn't. Yeah, you did. You're coming with us. In America, in foreign countries, you'd be going with them. They're going to take you. But in America, you have a right to present that in front of the jury of 12 and make them prove their case. You don't present it in front of a 12 statutory judges. No, you present people common to the area and common to you.
So ultimately, you're saying the theory has plausibility, but it would ultimately reside on the jury.
Yeah. If Monsanto can come in and say, hey, we spent $3 billion on creating this product, and jury goes, what product? Well, they have other scientists come in and explain it to them that with this product, this bug doesn't eat this corn like it used to, and it used to cost Americans $100 billion a year because of root worm damage or so forth, and we perfected it so that doesn't happen, and we saved America lots of money by perfecting this. The jury would go, yeah, you have a right to that. But now, as far as that vaccine goes, if the employer is requiring you to take it, we got documents that you send the employer that places the burden of responsibility on that employer of any damage. And most employers, upon a little investigation, will realize that there's potential for a lot of damage with these shots. And they could lose all their wealth by signing that document to force you to get the shot to
contain. It sounds like we need a lot of testing of that here real soon.
Yes, and it's it's an important test. It's freedom. Nowhere in the Bible is healthy people isolated. Only the sick are isolated. And God did that for a reason. So that's the way it should work today. If you're truly carrying something that's contagious, they can separate you for a time. But only for a time. They don't separate all of society from each other. They separate you. With this COVID-19 never wasn't a problem until they started vaccinating for it. That's when people started dying.
Well, it's the PCR test. It's the whole fraudulent part that's screwing everything up.
Yeah. They haven't even isolated it. I have trouble wrapping my head around the fact that they're even pulling this off. These vast majority of these medical people are so scared not to follow the hierarchy of it all.
Yeah.
I have a friend that goes in and talks to doctors, and he goes in. He's pretty knowledgeable, and he can go in and he talks to them for about a half an hour. He gets them to really relax with him, and the doctors lean over and he says, I would never make my children take these vaccines. And then they'll say, oh, why are you promoting vaccines? Because I'll lose my job if I don't. But I would
how can
never
you ever trust another doctor. How can you ever trust another doctor again?
Yeah. See, that doctor has taken a vow to not do harm and
I think the Hippocratic Oath was changed in 2005. They removed that do not harm part. I looked at it.
Well, they didn't change it very much. They just took out the words do not, so no big deal, is it?
Yeah, I need to get down and find out what they removed. But they did some major shifting.
No, I'm making it funny there, so it reads harm, not do not harm, harm.
Right. No, I missed that. Sorry.
Okay. Anything else, Brian? Got another question here.
No, sir. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Next is Tom from Eau Claire. Hello, Tom.
Hey, I even got unmuted this time.
Yeah.
How you doing?
Fine. How about yourself?
Yeah, I'm definitely doing well. In the interim of talking the other day, I've been going through my 14 drawers of fireproof file documents on my criminal suit. And as we kind of realize now, I was a patsy for my co-defendant and a couple other distinguished people in the court system. And I was reading some notes. I filed the jurisdiction. I challenged jurisdiction before I was given a public pretender. It was forced upon me. And my co-defendant never did. And we were having coffee one day in the lunchroom there at the courthouse. And he said that his attorney asked him, my co-defendant was asked by his attorney, public pretender, to explain positive law and public law. And I never did get into that. I don't know what it is. Does that make any sense to either one of you two guys?
Oh, yeah. BJ?
Positive law is law that is fully promulgated. It's
correct.
Positively law. That doesn't mean that law reaches the entire world or every man in America. No, but it does reach the scope of the legislature. Legislature means lawmaker, the scope of that lawmaker. Now, in America, the scope of that lawmaker reaches its subjects, like U.S. citizens and corporations, oftentimes abroad, no matter where they go in the world. And it definitely is operative on their land. So that's positive law. Now, if it's not positive law, if it's a law that's found in the revised statutes, Michael, why don't you explain the difference between revised statutes and statutes at large, which is positive law?
There is a process where law must be, quote, duly enacted and duly promulgated, quote, end quote. And unless something is duly enacted and duly promulgated, it is not law. If you look at the Internal Revenue Code, I think it's Title 26 or something like that, it's not never been duly enacted and duly promulgated. So it's just like an oath of office. If you get a judge's oath of office, and the oath of office looks really pretty and so forth, but you compare it to what the Constitution for that state says the oath of office must be, if the oath of office published by that judge is not as it's published in that state's Constitution, that is not a judge, just pretending to be one. Does that help?
Yeah, to a degree. I was just kind of puzzled here now after going through this here the last couple of days, because I filed the jurisdiction challenge in the courts, and my co-defendant didn't want nothing to do with it. Well, now I know why, because he didn't want to upset the conspiracy apparently he had against me. But his attorney did talk to him a little bit, but my public pretender, he wouldn't say boo when I tried to tell him, when a judge says you can refile the papers, and I did everything but, you know, jump on his big toe to get him to refile the papers. He wouldn't talk to me, he wouldn't acknowledge it, wouldn't do anything. So I just thought it was kind of interesting where the co-defendant did not file the papers and his attorney would talk to him, my attorney didn't want to even address the issue.
Right.
Yeah, there's, okay. I've been in federal court before, and the like a dummy, I thought I had a standby counsel, but when the trial started, he's all of a sudden he's my attorney. But which I didn't think was a huge problem, but it turned out to be a year and a half federal court, federal jail. But yeah, we challenged. I wrote up three jurisdictional challenges: personal, subject matter, and territorial. And that judge did everything she could to make sure that didn't show up in the record. So they ended up filing it in the case, supposedly. But when I went back to look, the oral arguments were scrubbed out of the record, and the documents disappeared. So if those documents are not true, why would they bother removing them? Risk their career to get them removed. That tells you the power of these things.
That also shares with you why it's so important that when you file something into the record, that you bring three originals with you. Three originals. And they will take one from you, and they'll stamp it on their end. And then the other two that you hand them, being exact copies, you ask them to timestamp date received for them. And then you keep one at home, and you keep one somewhere else. And you build the record, you build an exact copy of everything on that docket sheet. And when something like this happens and things disappear, well, okay. You give them a photocopy to correct their error. And I've had it done to me.
Yeah, when you walk into the courtroom, I mean the court clerk, let's say it's 7 days before you want to file a motion for hearing. So you walk in 8 days before, and you hand the court clerk your document, and they timestamp it. And that's an original signed document. So you'll have two other documents with you that are that copy of that document. So they're going to be copies. They're not going to be wet ink signed. So you have those timestamped also. And then you, if you really think they're going to be up to mischief, you ask for a certified copy of the document that you just filed. And they'll give it to you for $2.50 usually. Then you do not lose that. Do not keep that in your house because your house might burn down. This case is big. And then when you go into court, then you give the court notice of the filing, and you ask them to take judicial notice of it. Now it has no value in the court proceeding until you give judicial notice to the court. Because it's not before the court until you give judicial. He doesn't have to notice it until you notice him of it. So, and then ideally, when you put statutes at large in there, which is positive law, you get a certified copy of the archiver of that statute. If your case is really important, get a certified copy of it, and then you give that to the judge for judicial notice. And he just does not have no wiggle room. One judge told me he doesn't have to take judicial notice of anything that's not certified. And it makes sense because he doesn't know. He can't make a determination on the application of the law unless it's certified. You could go in there and change a couple words to get yourself out of that bind. And then he makes a determination and then, week later, the opposing party comes in and says, hey, wait a minute, PJ, he took out two key words that, and because those two words are missing, we can see why you rule in his favor, but they're not. Here's a certified copy of it. So the judge would go, oh my gosh, this is bad. I should have never done that. But anyway, that's what you do. You give them you get that stuff certified and get it before the judge, and it's a whole lot of work. Now, normally, an attorney puts in those judicial notices, but an attorney doesn't have to certify documents. And actually, a non-attorney is not even supposed to get a certificate of proof. They're supposed to put in an affidavit of proof of mailing, and so forth. They're not qualified to certify anything, but an attorney can because he's under basically a license under with the court. But anyway, there are a lot of little things that they haven't designed, so you can virtually never win if that's what they want. Go ahead, Michael.
No, that's about it.
Okay. I'm sitting on a sailboat here in Galveston, Texas, and beautiful night, supposed to get down to 70 tonight, which is pretty darn cool for Texas this time of the year. So, okay, you always say be well, Michael. I'll say be well. Bye-bye.
Sure, one more thing. You know, I've been making protein shakes, trying to make protein shakes, and how come every time I do, they end up being margaritas? I don't understand. I want to thank everybody for joining us this evening. Thank you, Tom, for your questions, and Brian and Ed. Until next week, good night, everybody, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.